This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, I'm Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan alongside Caroline O, and this is Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the Evening Edition, our monthly program that seeks to, as the title suggests, chronicle a defining moment in world history.
Yeah, that's right. So we kicked off with a pilot, this was in November, that commemorated the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. And by the way, you can download that podcast at bfm.my. So today, what we're doing is we're celebrating the Macintosh. And why? Well, because it was 30 years ago on January the 24th that Steve Jobs actually unveiled the Mac upon the world.
This is a Macintosh. It comes from a little company called Apple. Apple was started in a small town in Northern California by two friends, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. United by their common interest in technology and dissatisfied with the attempts at personal computers by others, they knew they could do better and set out to make the world's first good personal computer in the form of the Apple I. The Apple I became the Apple II. The Apple II became the cornerstone of an industry that would change the world. In 1984, Apple introduced Macintosh, and Macintosh thrusted the industry forward into a new era. Its style and ease of use gave computers to the rest of us and inspired the next revolution in computing.
30 years ago, there are grown men and women, working men and women, teachers, artists, photographers, CEOs, an entire generation who have never known a world without Macintosh. Mm. The launch of the Mac goes well beyond a key moment in Silicon Valley history or even computer history. In fact, it isn't an exaggeration to say that the launch was a watershed moment in world history.
Yeah, no, you can't deny that. I mean, computers are part of the everyday lives of virtually everyone. So the Macintosh was the turning point. Steve Jobs on that stage at the Flint Center in Cupertino. That marked the moment that the tools of the digital age were offered to all of us. And it was the moment that the artist in London, the novelist in KL, the photographer in Johannesburg, the kid down your street, and you were offered the chance to create and communicate in ways that you really couldn't before.
It was a computer with a price tag that was within reach for many. And more importantly, it was a computer that almost anyone could operate without going to school to become an expert. Mm-hmm. In a world dominated by ultra user-friendly computers and smartphones where a mouse and Windows are commonplace, it's easy to forget what PCs were like in 1984.
Really?
Looking for a powerful home computer? This is the one. Texas Instruments home computer. With 16K memory, it can take you a long way. Want a computer with a lot of software? Oh, yeah, this is the one. The TI home computer gives you more of these software cartridges than any computer in the world. The whole world. So, with all the power you have here to run all the power here, this is the one. The home computer from Texas Instruments.
Yeah, I mean, the best-selling ones, including the $5,000 IBM PC XT, the $600 Commodore 64, and Apple's own $1,200 Apple II, all they offered were black screens and typewriter-like lines of green and white letters, right?
Yeah, well, considering I use them, I don't find it hard to forget, Uma, perhaps a little before your time. But the Macintosh was actually priced between $1,995 and $2,495. It was aimed to change all that by introducing an affordable machine using the Windows and mouse system that Jobs had seen on a visit to Xerox, which had an early version of the system.
That's right, he kind of ripped it off. Now, the Mac was the brainchild of a guy called Jeff Raskin. He was a computer scientist from New York who had joined Apple in 1970 and believed that computers needed to be easier to use. After seeing the futuristic computer systems at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, or Xerox Park, which used graphics instead of text input and used a mouse as well as a keyboard, Raskin decided that it was the only way to successfully sell computers to millions of people. He would name the project after his favorite variety of tree-grown apple, the Macintosh.
But of course, in the early days, Jobs saw the Mac as an unwelcome diversion and potential competition for his own project, which was
meet the lady. Her name is Lisa, and she's the most exciting thing to happen in computers today. The Lady Lisa, beautiful, a classic triumph for Apple. Pure and simple graphic images and a clever pointing device called a mouse. But most importantly, unlimited expandability, unlimited power. Lisa, from Apple. The future today at Wallace Micromart.
That was named after his first child.
Right. It was also priced at, I think, $10,000. So expensive.
Very expensive. So the Lisa was also based on a graphical interface, but following a series of clashes with his own team, he then found a home with the Macintosh group. So Steve Jobs would take part of Raskin's vision of low-cost, usable machines and mold it into his own image.
The Mac would come into this world not kicking and screaming, but with bells on, with spotlights, with fanfare, with one of the biggest and most expensive marketing and product product launches at the time. Steve Jobs believed he was changing the world, and he wanted the rest of us to believe it too. How? With the world's best advertisement, of course. After this, 1984 Apple style. Stay with us. This is Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on BFM 89.9. And we're back. Good evening. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the Evening Edition with Caroline and Uma, our monthly program that celebrates a defining moment in history. We're taking a look back at the Mac, which was launched 30 years ago today. Now, there are two moments that mark the launching of the Macintosh. One would change the personal computing industry, and the other would change the marketing and advertising industry.
Now, we'll get to personal computing in a bit, but first, let's talk about that ad. So, the now infamous 1984 ad, how it got made, and how it almost never saw the light of day. From the very beginning, Apple always had a flair for marketing. Mike Mercola believed that a fledgling venture needed to act like a successful company if it wanted to become one, even if it was just a case of external perceptions. Steve Jobs always insisted on the highest possible production values, even while Apple was still in the garage. So it's a philosophy that they still practice today.
The Apple II, for example, would feature an expansive two-page spread in the September 1977 issue of Scientific American, even though Apple had less than 20 employees and minimal sales at the time.
I'm here with an average American homemaker with her own Apple personal computer. Jill, do you use your Apple for household budgeting? And
actually, I'm working in gold futures.
Well, you could probably put a lot of recipes in there, huh?
Mm-hmm. And you can do trend analyses, generate bar graphs.
Are you really a homemaker?
Of course.
So, Apple is the appliance of the 80s for all those pesky household chores.
I also own a small steel mill.
Apple's advertising agency was Chat Day. I think that's how it's pronounced. So, toward the end of 1982, the art director, Brent Thomas and Steve Hayden, came up with the idea of doing an ad campaign based on the timely tagline, "Why 1984 won't be like 1984. So, they shopped it around to a number of clients, including Apple, where it was proposed to be used for a print ad in the Wall Street Journal promoting the Apple II, but Apple didn't go for it, and the idea was then filed away until spring of 1983, when they met with the Mac marketing team to start working on the launch, which was scheduled for January of 1984.
Steve Jobs wanted to launch the Macintosh with an inspiring commercial that was as revolutionary as the product itself. He loved the Orwellian tagline, "Why 1984 won't be like 1984, and he encouraged the Chat Day team to pursue it. Steve Hayden and Brent Thomas put together an intriguing storyboard envisioning a visually striking, highly symbolic, miniature science fiction epic, right? A movie in 1 minute featuring a young female athlete who liberates the subjugated masses from totalitarian domination by throwing a sledgehammer to smash a huge screen displaying Big Brother, you know, IBM.
Mm-hmm. Macintosh marketing manager was Mike Murray and Steve Jobs. They loved it, but they needed to get new CEO John Sculley's approval because it was really large expenditure. So Sculley was a bit apprehensive, and understandably so. Remember, this was a 1 minute commercial with a production budget of over $750,000 that hardly mentions the Macintosh at all. But he would, you know, eventually put his apprehensions aside and approve the ad.
Right? Mm. Yeah, hardly mentioning the Macintosh at all. Chat Day hired the best science fiction oriented director they could find, who was Ridley Scott. He did, you know, the movie Blade Runner. He possessed the visionary dystopian feel they were striving for.
Well, what was your reaction when you first saw the board?
The board, I thought one of two things. I thought, my God, they're mad, because this is terrific from a filmic point of view, and I know exactly how to do a kind of pastiche on what 1984 may be in dramatic terms rather than factual terms, right? And so I thought it was such a dramatic idea that it would either be totally successful or would all get put in state pen.
Were there bits of things that you'd done in Alien that found their way into 84?
Yeah. Because in Alien, the whole process of Alien on the Nostromo, the spaceship, the ship itself, not the alien ship, was that it became a sculptural problem as to how you make those corridors look businesslike and mm-hmm. real. And so what we did very simply, finally, is in frustration, we bought three aircraft and dismantled them. Mm. And those three big jet bombers actually were then assembled in the corridors in the sculptural process. And that's why it looked very businesslike.
Oh, yes.
Now, those two big blank walls at the back of the main auditorium in 1984, we hauled in those huge 747 engines and mm-hmm. just hung them on the wall. Yeah. And they looked like, what did they look like? I don't know, they looked like ducts.
Air conditioning ducts.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Some kind of industrial.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something or other. Yeah.
So that is, to me, what I call good dramatic bullshit.
Now, Scott was based in London, so they decided they're going to fly out there and film it at Shepperton Studios.
Now, Scott's team had assembled a cast of almost 200 to play the oppressed, downtrodden, bullheaded workers. His people recruited dozens of authentic British skinheads, paying them about $125 a day to participate. It was harder to cast the young heroines, since most of the models who actually tried out had trouble spinning with the heavy sledgehammer that was involved. So luckily, one named Anya Major was an accomplished discus thrower, and she could do it faultlessly, so she got the part.
Did you have any thoughts on the girl, that as you looked at the board, what sort of person that would be? Let's start there and work back to the...
As you remember, one of the main problems was actually, funny, finding a girl who could throw a hammer mm-hmm. and look businesslike.
Mm-hmm.
And so that immediately narrowed down the field, apart from the fact she had to look great.
Mm-hmm.
It narrowed down the field, I think, almost immediately to athletes, because we went through the whole process of having, you know, models come in and mm-hmm. actresses come in.
Those Hyde Park days of...
The Hyde Park days of casting, which was actually very pleasant. But we finally narrowed it down to actually seeing athletes, discus throwers, hammer throwers. And she really was, I think, out of everybody we saw, was really the only one,
mm-hmm.
you know, who looked right
yeah.
and could handle herself.
The commercial, we know, was classy, suspenseful, enigmatic, and it seemed to garner lots of attention. It was shown for the first time at Apple's 1983 annual sales conference in Honolulu to a rapturous reception. The response was so great that Apple booked two expensive slots for 60 seconds and 30 seconds, and that cost over $1 million to show it at the Super Bowl, which was just 2 days before the Mac introduction.
So Mike Murray and Steve Jobs screened the commercial for Apple's board of directors in December to get final approval for the huge Super Bowl expenditures. So to their surprise, every outside board member seemed to despise the commercial, with Mike McCullough suggesting that Apple begin a hunt for a new ad agency, believe it or not. So one of the board members remarked that it was the worst commercial that he had ever seen. So Steve and Mike were pretty much devastated, really.
Yeah, the chilling reception from the board compelled John Skelly to ask Shiat Day to sell back both time slots that they had purchased. But Jay Shiat was true to form and only sold off the 30-second slot, basically telling Apple that he wasn't able to get rid of the longer one. Apple considered using the slot for a more conventional commercial, but in the end decided to take a chance with the 1984 spot. It's a good thing they did.
Yeah.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the information purification directives. We have created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology, where each worker may bloom, secure from the pests of their incompetence. More powerful a weapon than any fleet or army on earth. We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
After the Super Bowl, the commercial ran again, only this time on the evening news show. So apparently, it made such a big impression on lots of viewers that, coupled with the fact that it was only supposed to run once, it became a news item itself, as well as increasing expectations for the upcoming launch. It actually ran dozens of times on news shows in the next couple of days, gathering Apple over $5 million worth of free publicity.
The commercial would go on to win just about every possible award, including Best Commercial of the Decade. 20 years later, it is considered one of the most memorable television commercials ever made. When we come back, launch day, January 14th, 1984, Macintosh introduces himself to the world. Say what? Stay tuned. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. Good evening, I'm Uma Paganampake Pagan alongside Caroline O, and you're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the Evening Edition, our monthly program that seeks to, like the title suggests, mark an important moment in history. 30 years ago, Steve Jobs would unveil the Macintosh computer at a shareholders' meeting at the Flint Center in Cupertino. It was a historic moment in Silicon Valley history, in the history of modern computing even, as historic as the coin flip that christened Hewlett-Packard and the traitorous 8 mutiny that launched Fairchild Semiconductor and the microchip industry.
So here's how it went down. The lights dimmed and Steve Jobs would actually begin by rapping Bob Dylan.
I'd like to open the meeting with a part of an old poem, about a 20-year-old poem by Dylan. That's Bob Dylan. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pens, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing.
He thanked the board of directors, invited his CEO, John Sculley, to the stage for a report on business, and after Sculley's speech, the lights dimmed again, Steve Jobs would once again appear on the left side of the stage.
It is 1958, he would begin, speaking slowly and dramatically. IBM passes up a chance to buy a young fledgling company that has invented a new technology called xerography. 2 years later, Xerox was born, and IBM has been kicking themselves ever since. The crowd laughs and Steve pauses.
He continues with the usual passion, intensity and emotion dripping from his voice. It is 10 years later, the late 60s Digital Equipment Corporation and others invent the mini computer. IBM dismisses the mini computer as too small to do serious computing and therefore unimportant to their business. DEC grows to be a multi-hundred million dollar company before IBM enters the mini computer market.
He pauses again.
It is now 10 years later, the late 70s. In 1977, Apple, a young, fledgling company on the West Coast, invents the Apple II, the first personal computer as we know it today. IBM dismisses the personal computer as too small to do serious computing and therefore unimportant to their business.
The early 1980s, 1981, Apple II has become the world's most popular computer, and Apple has grown to a $300 million corporation, becoming the fastest growing company in American business history. Now, with over 50 companies vying for a share, IBM enters the personal computer market in November of 1981 with the IBM PC. Steve is speaking very quickly now, picking up momentum.
1983. Apple and IBM emerge as the industry's strongest competitors, each selling approximately $1 billion worth of personal computers in 1983. Each will invest greater than $50 million for R&D and another $50 million for television advertising in 1984, totaling almost $250 million combined.
The shakeout is in full swing. The first major personal computer firm goes bankrupt, with others teetering on the brink. Total industry losses for 1983 overshadow even the combined profits of Apple and IBM.
He slows down, speaking emphatically.
It is now 1984. It appears IBM wants it all. Apple is perceived to be the only hope to offer IBM a run for its money. Dealers initially welcoming IBM with open arms now fear an IBM-dominated and controlled future. They are increasingly turning back to Apple as the only force that can ensure their future freedom.
Steve pauses even longer as the crowd's cheering swells. He has turned them on the edge of their seats.
IBM wants it all and is aiming its guns on its last obstacle to industry control, Apple. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry? The entire information age? Was George Orwell right?
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the information purification methods created for the first time in all history. A garden.
The crowd is in a frenzy now as the already famous 1984 commercial, which was shown for the first and only time during the Super Bowl 2 days ago, fills the screen, featuring a beautiful young woman athlete storming into a meeting of futuristic skinheads, throwing a sledgehammer at Big Brother, imploding the screen in a burst of apocalyptic light.
One result, one cause.
Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh, and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
By the time the commercial is finished, everyone in the auditorium is standing and cheering.
There have only been two milestone products in our industry.
Steve describes the Macintosh as the third industry milestone product after the Apple II and the IBM PC.
The Apple II in 1977 and the IBM PC in 1981. Today, 1 year after Lisa, we are introducing the third industry milestone product, Macintosh. Many of us have been working on Macintosh for over 2 years now, and it has turned out insanely great. And we are introducing Macintosh at a mainstream price point of $2,495. And you can go see a Macintosh in any one of our over 1,500 dealers in America today. You've just seen some pictures of Macintosh. Now I'd like to show you Macintosh in person. All of the images you are about to see on the large screen will be generated by what's in that bag.
Now, all this time, a lone Macintosh has been sitting in its canvas carrying case near the center of the stage. Steve walks over to the bag, opens it up, unveiling the Mac to the world for the very first time. He pulls it out, plugs it in, inserting a floppy back in the day, and the demo begins to run flawlessly. The Macintosh becomes the first computer to introduce itself, speaking in a tremulous voice.
For the first time ever, I'd like to let Macintosh speak for itself.
Hello, I'm Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag. And accustomed as I am to public speaking, I'd like to share with you a maxim I thought of the first time I met an IBM mainframe. Never trust a computer you can't lift. Obviously I can talk, but right now, I'd like to sit back and listen. So it is with considerable pride that I introduce a man who's been like a father to me, Steve Jobs.
Pandemonium reigns as the demo completes. Steve Jobs smiles from year to year. The ovation continues for at least 5 minutes before he quiets the crowd down. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the Evening Edition. After this, the enduring legacy of the Macintosh computer. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9. Good evening. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the Evening Edition with Caroline and Uma, our monthly program that commemorates a turning point in world history. 30 years ago today, Steve Jobs unveiled the Macintosh computer to the world. Very few tools transform culture, and the Macintosh has become a symbol of a sort of intellectual freedom, a signifier that someone has logged into the digital age.
My first Macintosh was an SE with a 30 megabyte hard drive.
The first Mac I used was my dad's classic. He had a Mac Classic, a Mac Plus.
First Macintosh I purchased was on the day of the introduction.
But I had an Apple II in 79, and then I had an Apple III, and then I got to play with a Lisa in 1980.
I had a blue and white G3, had a Lombard PowerBook, had a Pismo PowerBook, had a Titanium PowerBook.
I was given a Macintosh 128 as one of the first 100 people in the Mac division.
The first computer that we had.
But for all the fanfare, the original Mac didn't really take off because it was about $2,495. It was more expensive than many people wanted, so there were few programs for it only, and tools for desktop publishing hadn't really been developed.
But it would grow and evolve, and 30 years later, inexpensive personal computers controlled with a point and click of a mouse are as embedded in the fabric of everyday life. Heck, even when people say the word mouse, most of them actually refer to that computer device and not a rodent. The Mac helped catalyze a total change in the way the computers were used.
Now, while the Mac wasn't a totally new invention, it actually combined and built upon concepts that had been developed in Silicon Valley for years. Douglas Engelbart devised the first computer mouse. Teams like Xerox PARC had made great strides in creating the new ideas for how to use a computer. The Mac deserves a place in history as the machine that popularized such technologies. Credit deservedly goes to Apple for making it accessible and bringing it to the masses.
But the legacy of the Mac goes beyond the hardware and software that made the Mac the Mac. That was just part of it. There was also an underlying philosophy in its creation that may have just as long an impact. For this was also a moment in history when a group of techno pirates, if you will, free-thinking coders and designers, genuinely believed that they could challenge the status quo and that their passion and joy for changing the world might actually be enough to get the job done.
The Macintosh spirit was not something we created with a Macintosh, although we sort of contributed to it, but it was there before the Macintosh because it's really the spirit of the Apple II. And so much of the spirit of the Apple II is the spirit of Steve Wozniak's personality as well as Steve Jobs's.
Yeah, the core of Apple is to change the world, and that has not changed. I don't think it can. I don't think it could change if you tried to change it.
And in a broader sense, though, some of that spirit of the Apple II was the spirit of the personal computer revolution. And really, what that is more than anything else is celebration of unbounded possibility. The key thing, those first microcomputers, even pre-Apple II, but even the Apple IIs, couldn't really do much. Yet they were incredibly exciting because you knew they were the seed that would change the world.
And amid the playfulness and crazy power struggles, as is expected, there was brilliance that was ahead of their time and a sense that this was their time. It was counterculture and technology. You're either an artist or a drone, and would inspire generations of ragtag CEOs and wannabe entrepreneurs, right?
Yep. Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak believes there is an analogy with the car industry. So while his own Apple II was an integral part of the PC revolution, it'll be the Macintosh that goes down as a machine that changed the way we think about computers. He says, "I think the first Macintosh was like the Model T Ford. Even 25 years later, you can see the resemblance to it. Sure, one is a little bit cruder and simpler, but 20 years from now, we'll look at a Macintosh and pretty much understand the similarities."
20 years ago, Stephen Levy would write the following in Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the Computer That Changed Everything. He would say, "Ultimately, we can expect to lose count of Macintosh's successors. Long after its departure, Macintosh will be remembered as a product that brought just plain people uninterested in the particulars of technology into the trenches of the information age and did it with an unforgettable artistic flourish. In the process, it standardized the crucial bridge from metaphor to reality. Behold, a dent in the universe."
I've said this before. I thought it was worth repeating. It's in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough. That it's technology married with liberal arts, married with the humanities, that yields us the result that makes our hearts sing.
You've been listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia as we commemorate the 30th anniversary of the Macintosh. This is the evening edition signing off on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.